This is session 510, entitled How We Appraise When Theory Meets Reality. I'm Carl Van Ness. I'm head of archives and manuscripts at the University of Florida. And as of 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, I'm the chair of the acquisitions and appraisal section. The purpose of this session is to explore how archivists learn the, and you can pick your choice of words here, art, practice, or theory of appraisal. You can pick all three if you want. They're not mutually exclusive. I usually refer to it as the art of practice. The idea for the session was inspired by research being conducted by our first speaker, Kim Anderson. Kim is a doctoral candidate in information studies at UCLA and is currently conducting research for her dissertation in understanding how appraisal is learned. Her presentation this morning will focus on the results of her pilot study. Prior to her doctoral work, Kim completed her MLS, also at UCLA, and has worked since 1995 in a variety of archives and libraries, university archives, special collections, manuscripts, and law libraries. To respond to Kim's survey, we've solicited the opinions of an archival educator who teaches appraisal and a practitioner with many years of appraisal experience. Our archival educator, the second speaker, is Pat Galloway. Professor Galloway holds PhDs, emphasis on the S, plural, in comparative literature and anthropology from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Since 2000, she has been on the faculty of the School of Information here at the University of Texas, where she is associate professor in archival enterprise and teaches courses in digital archives, archival appraisal, and historical museums. She has worked in a number of fields and was a practitioner for many years herself, from 1979 to 2000 at the Mississippi Department of Archives and History. She is also the author of many books. Oh, a lot of latecomers coming in here. Thank you. She is also the author of many books and articles, primarily in the area of ethnohistory and archaeology. Representing practitioners on the panel is Nancy Young, who is the college archivist at Smith College, where this spring she passed her 11-year mark. Over the years, she has given papers on a number of topics, including the nature of collecting, archives and the internet, women's friendships, and other cultural aspects of college life and the internet. College life at home and abroad. I need to just read my notes. As well as given presentations on a wide variety of topics to undergraduates. Before she came to Smith, Nancy held appointments at Princeton and Yale and was an NHPRC fellow at the New York State Archives. She is active in SAA, and I will add that Nancy was also the inspiration for the session's subtitle, When Theory Meets Reality. Before I pass it on to Kim, and perhaps we should wait another minute while people are still filtering in, we envision this as a dialogue, and we hope it is a dialogue. The presentations will be kept short, we hope, and we hope to leave enough room for a conversation at the end. And without further ado, pass it to Kim.
Thank you. So as he mentioned, my name is Kim Anderson, and I'm going to report on my pilot study. However, my pilot study is a pilot study done for my dissertation, so it's not statistically accurate. It's basically more of an exploration of themes that come up in appraisal learning. So last summer, I conducted a pilot study in which I asked university archivists to tell me about their appraisal experiences, education, and current job. I began this project with the idea that I would simply ask archivists how they learned to appraise. I imagine they would say something like, oh, I read the department's manual, or oh, I applied so-and-so's model, or well, I had to learn by doing. What I found instead was much more complicated. Many of the archivists I spoke with indicated that they learned from others or taught themselves. Appraisal learning appears to be an ongoing process that doesn't have a simple how I learned story. Rather, appraisal learning is heavily influenced by the institutional context and is partly reactive. You learn because you have to, because there is a collection you have to make a decision about. I'm reluctant to make too many generalizations, as I said, as I only spoke with 7 archivists. I urge the audience to remember that these are individuals, and their life experiences may not be reflective of the experience of college and university archivists in general. Furthermore, I will talk about them periodically as an aggregate, but again, that does not mean that everyone interviewed shared the same experiences or perspective. However, even in this small group, some common themes emerged, and it's those that I would like to explore today. First, as I said, I interviewed 7 archivists that work in colleges and universities around the country. The archivists were selected semi-randomly, and I'd like to reiterate that these are institutional archivists for colleges or universities, not special collections archivists. Well, they have multiple, some people had multiple hats, which is fairly normal, but the criteria for selection was institutional archivists of a college or university archive. The archivists were selected semi-randomly, and as I said, I started with someone I knew, but the rest were selected. They were people I had no acquaintance with at all, and they were just members of the CNU section. I contacted several more people, but was ultimately not able to interview them. And I did attempt to contact archivists from different parts of the country, from both private and public schools, and from different kinds of colleges and universities. I wanted to make sure that I had a broad range. Unfortunately, I ended up, the people who responded ended up being almost primarily from public universities. But I am pleased with the sort of range of institutions I got to talk to people from. Each interview lasted between 40 and 60 minutes and was preceded by email correspondence. The colleges and universities at which they serve as university archivists range in size and undergraduate enrollment from 4,340 to 35,898. And the institutions were founded as early as 1853 and as late as 1974. 6 of the archivists work at public institutions, as I said, but one has worked at both a public and a private institution. And I'm aware of that disparity or, you know, lack of breadth, so I will be fixing that for my future studies. But every archivist had a graduate degree of some kind. 5 of the archivists have an MA in history or an MFA, 3 of which also have an MLIS. 1 had an MLIS only, and 3 were certified archivists. Every archivist, regardless of degree, sought out additional education either through workshops offered by SAA or at conferences, intensive training institutes such as Modern Archives Institute, or through formal coursework in LIS or related fields they felt were relevant to the job they were doing, such as history of photography or museum coursework. And then on to the themes. So one of the themes that came up a lot was early influences and first experiences. Nearly every archivist remembered a specific professor, teacher, or supervisor at work who provided guidelines for how to appraise. This doesn't mean that the guidelines necessarily translated directly into actual appraisal practice. Several of the archivists commented on the difference between the world of theory and practice. 2 of those who had supervisors as teachers used the word mentor when describing them. 3 of the archivists remembered specific techniques or approaches they had learned in class that they found useful, such as sampling, and that came up a lot. It's not really appraisal, it's more of a technique. It's a technique that people found helpful to keep in mind when they were deciding what to keep. Many first archives experiences occurred as an intern or student worker in a special collections department or historical society while working with manuscript material. First appraisal experiences varied. Some were as interns under supervision, and other archivists did not appraise until they became the university archivist. And then the next theme was sources for learning, or the sorts of materials people made use of to learn. Some of the archivists spoke specifically about teaching themselves. Thigri mentioned reading up on the university's history. Another archivist sought out further education through coursework, as I mentioned earlier, to help with the particular collections he or she was working with. And 4 of the archivists cited specific archival literature, and I would like to say that this was unprompted. I did not request literature, so I thought this was interesting. The 4 that they mentioned were Leonard Rappert's No Grandfather Clause, Maynard Bridgeford's Appraisal and Accessioning, which is the first of the appraisal basic manual series, Bowles and Young's Black Box Method, and Helen Samuel's Varsity Letters. Only 2 archivists described using departmental manuals as a significant part of their training and learning. And then this is another thing that came up that I wasn't necessarily expecting to be part of appraisal, but post-custodial appraisal, or weeding. And by post-custodial, I mean after you have it in your possession and it's been accessioned. Many of the archivists expressed early fears of weeding that dissipated as time went on and their confidence grew. However, one reported having no hesitation from the beginning, so again, it's not everyone feels the same way. Several archivists also commented on cost of administration and storage while talking about weeding during processing the accessioning and appraisal. So I guess the main point is that factors other than enduring value are considered in appraisal and selection, which I think everyone probably knew. 2 of the archivists, again, specifically mentioned sampling as a technique they used when working with large collections. And I should explain, the structure of the interviews was such that they were semi-structured, so I had some points I wanted to get to, but I also wanted the person's experiences to lead the discussion. So that's why I'm getting kind of a wide variety of things that come up that I wasn't necessarily asking about, which is great because I wanted to explore. That was the whole point of it. So another theme was negotiating the political. And one of the archivists commented that appraisal was an educational process, that the archivist was educating the campus departments whenever appraisal and accessioning occurred. Three others specifically described how appraisal activities involve the local community beyond the university, i.e. in encouraging research in the archive, documentation of the local community, or simply in recognizing the community as stakeholders. Serving these multiple constituencies makes appraisal very difficult, particularly when the need of the university for privacy or healing may conflict with the need of the public for access and information. When asked what the role of the university archives was in the university and society at large, one archivist replied, quote, to document the history of the university and see that its roots in the past are not severed, and that means the good and the bad. There's some things that you're proud of in your institution, but there's some things that you wish maybe that didn't happen. But you know, you don't want to bury that. You might want to make sure that those materials are available to students, researchers, and then to the community at large, end quote. Part of this link to the local community may have to do with the archives or archivist position within a special collections department that has a regional collecting focus, and that's something I didn't address with this study, is the administrative structures of each university archive. Most of the archivists either served as head of special collections in addition to university archivist, or the university archives was a unit within the special collections. In either case, the archivist had to work within both an institutional records and manuscripts, within both an institutional records and a manuscripts environment. It is unclear how this may impact appraisal decisions, but archivists did comment on the mixing of personal institutional records within collections, particularly with faculty papers. And then a specific appraisal practice came up. I've already mentioned that two of the archivists described using sampling techniques. Again, not classifying that as appraisal necessarily, was related. Two archivists also said that they used collective decision-making for pre-custodial appraisal, appraisal you do before you accession. One of the archivists also conducts appraisal in the field this way, with teams of two or more looking at the materials. This means that the potential collection is discussed as a group prior to its accession. One of the archivists who uses collective appraisal noted that, quote, we bring our biases to it, end quote. Collective appraisal may help to temper the inclinations of any one archivist. So I have some conclusions I'd like to draw, or rather, these are conclusions for further thought, not definitive conclusions about appraisal. One is that the structural, functional, and political analysis of institutions is a recurring undercurrent in university archives appraisal. This may be an area to try to incorporate more directly into archival education, i.e. how can archivists navigate political environments? How can they prepare to understand both formal and informal institutional structures? Secondly, the specific works mentioned by some of the archivists seem like logical choices for university archives. However, we don't have research that indicates if the archivists are applying particular theoretical frameworks and finding them useful. In short, we keep writing literature, but is it being read or used? And more importantly, is it helpful? Perhaps it would change our understanding of archival practice and archival materials if we learned that X percent of university archivists follow Bowles' flowcharts, or that Y percent employ sampling with collections of certain sizes. And third, collective appraisal may be widely practiced in university or college archives. I can't tell from the seven people I talked to. But it is unclear if this aspect of professional life has been studied. In effect, the hands-on appraisers box method, and what I mean by that is many of the people I talked to had experiences in their classes or their appraisal classes where they were asked to look at a small set of materials, and I think that's fairly common. In effect, the hands-on appraisers box method, sometimes used in appraisal classes, teaches collective appraisal if the students are doing it as group work. Is the collective versus individual appraisal process something that should be addressed by education? What impact does it have on how we learn? And fourth, as appraisal seems to be ultimately learned over time as you do it, and most early archives experiences reported here were as interns or students, internships involving both pre- and post-custodial appraisal are needed to help students learn how to appraise. If students don't have the experiences of appraising, what that means then is we're waiting until people get jobs working with real materials without a safety net appraising. If you supervise interns, see if there's a way you could involve them in appraisal at your institution. If you are a professor, encourage students to ask about appraisal opportunities at their internship sites. The learning over time aspect is very significant because it means that, one, we can't teach appraisal completely in school, and two, that continuing education is important, and three, that hands-on classroom appraisal activities will have limited effectiveness. And finally, the archivist interview demonstrated self-sufficiency, analytical skill, and the ability to teach oneself. Archival work is intellectually demanding and requires the ability to adapt and learn over time. I would like to thank the archivists who shared their times and stories with me. This brief presentation is inadequate to convey all of what they said, but I've done my best to draw out the most salient points. I thank you for your time.
Okay, when I came to Texas, I was not thinking that I would teach appraisal, but about 2 years in, David Gracie said, "Here's my syllabus, it's yours." I thought, right, I'm going to follow that act. But anyway, so I undertook to start to try to figure out how to teach appraisal. So I'm just going to sort of race through this a bit and talk about my own practice in teaching it and some of the how this has interacted with what Kimberly had to say. I have to say, once I read her report, I was a little bit worried because I thought, well, okay, we can take the pragmatic stance and say appraisal will just have to be good enough and it can never be perfect, which of course a lot of us say. Plenty of writers say this, and they will get to the end of their writing on appraisal and they never, of course, say, this is my students are always complaining about this, but when's somebody going to say that this is the way to do it? Because of course this never happens. I really think that we can do better than this, and this is my anthropological stuff coming out. I think we can really do better than a set of rules of thumb from a day-long workshop. There are all kinds of different ways that we can go about this, but one of the things that is I think first important, and this is in the most recent literature, this is what you constantly see. We've gone to we've gone beyond the sort of positivist ideas into the idea that appraisal, like every other activity of archivists, is historically and culturally situated. And I believe I sort of wanted to wave this around because this is an old book, but Donald Schoen's The Reflective Practitioner, which is talked about a lot in information schools because it sort of comes from the education side, and there's a lot of interest in it. And it articulates some of the things that I think about the notion that when we hear people talk about how do you appraise, well, it's sort of, we say on the job or experience, but it's really reflective practice by people who have become informed prior to doing it. Because my students will say, okay, so when do we get to appraise? And I say, well, probably you won't be, unless you're a lone arranger, probably nobody's going to let you appraise until a while. You probably will have a mentor of some kind. You'll have somebody's shoulder over which to look. Maybe not, but probably. Because it is a serious activity, and most people are not just dumped into it. But it then requires that, having prepared yourself, you then will think reflexively about what you do every time. And every time it will be different because you will have added to your experience. And you will have, and hopefully the whole notion of being reflexive about this and reflective both, is that you foreground your practice so that you see what it is you're doing each time, not just keeping the activity naturalized, but you're constantly aware of the fact that it is a synthetic practice that you're carrying out. And so I absolutely agree that everything about appraisal can't be learned in the classroom. Only a fragment about appraisal can be learned in the classroom. But I think that the student can master the issues and prepare herself for the task with knowledge about how to research and critique the practice of her own archive and of any archive in which she may work. So my approach to teaching appraisal, of course, you can always look at my syllabi online, but it's summarized pretty well in a list of objectives for my course, which I'm going to sort of mention and comment on. The first thing that we do for certain is to review the history and concepts of archival appraisal as a practice of cultural construction. We read the theoretical writings, mostly of English-speaking archivists, and we look at local practice handbooks as a developmental sequence and look at what the practice is and how it has been built over time and where we now sit. and try to learn to detect influences and constraints, because there certainly have been. I see appraisal practice as a developing political economy of the holding of cultural objects. Then my students love me for this, because we read a lot of the classics, and then they have to write praise, and I say, put them in a notebook, you'll use them later. And I do get people, you know, calling me back and saying, yeah. Okay, anyway, I like to familiarize students with current appraisal practice and its implications in an institutional setting, including economic, political, theoretical, and professional issues. I mean, we have in this town, as you've seen, bazillions of archives of government, private entities, university, et cetera, et cetera. So we discuss appraisal in government, business, manuscript repositories, private nonprofit environments, et cetera. And often we have student experiences to draw upon in the class, because we often have students who have been practitioners. They may not have appraised directly, but they may have worked on teams, as Kim mentioned, or they may have been involved as a junior member of a group that's looking at appraisal. And then I also invite some of our nice Austin and Roundabout archivists to come in and talk about cases. Because I find that's very engaging for students. They get to hear about a live case of an appraisal and gnarly problems that have come up, and especially to hear about institutional context and how important that is. Then I like to expose students to the implications of appraisal in terms of its effect on meaning through comparative appraisal exercises. And it's not appraise this box. It's appraise your backpack. It's a very interesting exercise where we look at actually. This is a student working with their own stuff. I find it's really important and pedagogically very effective to work from something people really understand and know. And depending on when we do the exercise, sometimes I place it one place, sometimes another. You know, we'd sort of as to how many theories they've read so far. I remember when I was taking a survey of philosophy, and every time we read something new, I thought, oh, this is better than the last, and I would speak, you know, converted serially. This is kind of the way it is with the appraisal practices. But anyway, I have them appraise the contents of their own backpacks, and then I give them a brown paper bag and say, okay, if there's anything in your backpack you don't want anyone else to see, put it in the brown paper bag and swap backpacks. And then we do the same thing again. We use a form, and then we compare. And out of that emerges a grasp of the fact that no two people are going to appraise the same way. And they don't have to appraise a real collection to find that out. And especially given that it's their own stuff, they also start to understand that if you aren't the creator, or the creator isn't alive, you're sort of doing it a bit in the dark. And you have to sort of look at what kinds of mistakes can you make and see that. And we discuss all this in class. I try to sort of think up these different ways to do this. This year we're going to do another one where we have a standard set of materials that I give to teams, and each team is going to use a different appraisal method, and then we're going to compare. That kind of thing, to sort of try to figure out what does happen. How do we alter the meaning of a collection through appraisal? And is this a serious thing that we want to consider? My goal in this is to encourage students to be reflective in their practice again, knowing that we can't ever be perfect. I'll go for that every time. I want to also prepare students to review existing appraisal policies and past appraisal decisions, and to prepare appropriate documentation plans for a given archival environment. And I spot a few archivists from Austin who. I tell my students, don't pester the archivist too much. But what I have them do is what I refer to as a forensic method, where they go and look at what goes on in, go and look at the collections in a given repository. I require them to go to a repository and then look at how the collections, how it got there is documented. and how and what kind of appraisal practice is implicated in its presence there. This is a way of sort of saying, what does the user see? How is the user served by this? And especially, what kinds of conclusions does the user draw about the institution itself by its contents and the choices that were made or not made? Finally, I want the students to understand about the necessities of negotiation with archival constituencies, and that includes archival staffs and archival policies. Because they have to understand that those things exist or they cannot deal with the underlying value issues. Let me just read this. Once a student emerges from this course, I don't expect them to be fully practiced appraisers, but I do expect they're fully cognizant of the gravity of what they do and that what they do should be based on a self-conscious awareness of how what they are doing fits into a larger picture. And in that context, the discussion about documentation strategy yesterday is very, very pertinent. This is why this concept of a reflective practitioner, and there are many other sources for this approach, including Bourdieu and others, but the notion of a prepared and qualified professional who has adequate theoretical knowledge, who approaches a unique and indeterminate problem by applying what she already knows in innovative ways through a set of mental simulation exercises. I mean, it really is an experiment or a quasi-experiment that you do every time you appraise until you're satisfied that the solution to the problem fits the uniqueness of the collection. And I've got a bunch of other things to say, but I'll hold off on that until the discussion. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm going to admit that I'm new to the lens situation, so I hope you'll be patient with me because I'm middle aged. Sometimes I look down and it looks really great, and then other times I look up and it's like, oh my God, what's out there? So my subtitle, Travels from Theory to Reality in the Appraisal Journey. I actually considered singing the Clampett song. You know. Here's a story about a man named Jim. Inserting, of course, my name, but it just didn't sound quite right. But I have a confession to make about appraisal theory. I hate it. What did I say? I hate it. I'm a practitioner. I read theory. I yawn. Then I go about and do my work, which sometimes follows actual appraisal theory, so it does work out in the end. But it's been really sort of interesting to look back on a nearly quarter of a century in the archives profession to see what I'm doing right, what I'm doing wrong, and then to share some stories, particularly about my early days. So I hope I don't bore you. My undergraduate liberal arts education really provided me with a basic understanding, a general knowledge base for the work that I do as an archivist. More importantly, it's taught me how to research and to learn what I need to know about appraisal and my other experiences in the archives. Kimberly's study suggests that archivist has to know the subject of her project as if it were her own, and I couldn't agree more. I would also add that archivists need to know how to teach skills to herself and other additional skills that will take us through this appraising process. My first professional assignment was to process the papers of a child psychoanalyst. Nancy had a BA in history. Geez, what am I going to do? It was a great leap of faith for Yale University, I have to admit. God love them. From Psych 101, I knew the term longitudinal studies. And I had just barely a concept of separation individuation theory, which was this woman's particular field. Yet here I was about to make decisions about what was retained in this psychoanalyst's papers. My liberal arts education gave me the skill set to research and understand the rudiments of this field. I did some background reading and then did the fateful thing of consulting with psychoanalysts. Ooh, that was pretty exciting, actually. So only then could I begin to understand the basic underpinnings of this woman's work and the value of her work, let alone what the heck was she talking about. Discussions with my professional colleagues gave me the confidence that I was making the right appraisal choices. So overall, looking back, I think I did a pretty good job. I took a look at the finding aid the other day and was like, wow, okay, I remember doing that. Sometimes the records themselves speak to us when this is something that has come into us and we are starting to process it. So today, glancing over the finding aid, you might actually take a look at the finding aid and see that I kept a file of photographs of beagles. And you're going to say, why the heck did Nancy keep this file of photographs of beagles? Part of Series 6, Photographs, the Margaret S. Mahler Papers at Manuscripts and Archives at Yale. And I'll tell you that I justify this decision by saying that by reading her correspondence, her family correspondence, her professional correspondence, her journals and her diaries, she loved these dogs. It was great. It was absolutely fantastic to see this woman who otherwise was cold as ice. Cold as ice. I mean, her letters to her husband when they were continents apart. Whoa, no, not love letters. Not love letters at all. So reading these comments about these dogs, these beagles. Now, I must make a confession. I have a beagle at home, so perhaps that's my bias coming out so early on. But, you know, reading those letters, reading those diaries, it was very evident that there was a human side to Ms. Margaret Mahler. I hope there are no relatives of Ms. Mahler here in the audience today. So, you know, even something very silly as a file folder of beagle photos is very important to give a sense of Margaret's complete life. Appraisal involves developing knowledge to make informed decisions. And sometimes, particularly in the context of college and university archives, it's not strictly from the history books, but it surrounds you. And I think this is what Kimberly was talking about or sort of getting at when her respondents were talking about the political landscapes in each of our institutions. Knowing how an office operates historically can actually help you today to understand what are those crazy people in development doing? What did they do years ago and 20 years later have decided to do the same thing over and over and over again? It didn't work 20 years ago. Will it work today? So relationships between offices are as equally important in deciphering some of these appraisal situations. The capacity to understand the nature of the office is also going to help you when you are called in to make the fast appraisal decisions. Now, I know, you know, we counsel our college colleagues not to do this. We try not to have ourselves placed in this position, but let's face it, the archivists are not always the first people to call when someone is moving from an office where they have to relinquish space from someplace. So I've been called into appraisal situations in offices where the shredding van motor is running right outside the door, and they say, oh, Nancy, does the archives want anything? So I'll talk a little bit more about where those offices are placed on my list. So keeping on top of how the various departments operate within your organization is a good thing, a great thing. How you accomplish this within your institution relies on what type of institution you're at, your longevity, and frankly, your stamina. Kimberly also points out in her presentation about the nature of appraisal experiences. Many of us did not learn this by ourselves through hands-on guided experiences, whether as a graduate student or otherwise. We learned to think about the records before us. My own appraisal journey started as an undergraduate with an internship at a state archives. I was very fortunate to hop on that bandwagon at the Pennsylvania State Archives. And it was under the guidance of someone who knew or was supposed to know more about the records than I. In graduate school, I had my first exposure to working with college and university archivists, and I thought, hey, they're cool, yeah. That's where I'm going to stay. After that, I interned with two corporations, one a technology firm and another an insurance giant in Hartford, Connecticut. Name one of them. So these varied experiences, I think, really truly flexed and developed my appraisal muscles. I observed professionals practicing what I call the nuanced art. Carl, we're in agreement. And many who were using very different standards. But, you know, it's holistic. This thing is a holistic thing that we do. I saw how they use collection policies to shape their decisions and that there were fantastic gray areas that every one of us needed to navigate. And I learned to ask the essential appraisal questions. Who created these records? What were they used for? How did they reflect the activities of the officer person? What kind of information is in them? And will anybody use them if we bring them into our archives? Opportunities for making decisions and for justifying those decisions are essential parts of our appraisal education, and it's great to hear that students are getting that opportunity. What kind of decision would I have made on my own as an undergraduate about the pornographic images I found in a photographer's collection of aerial shots he took for the Department of Health of flooded Harrisburg, Pennsylvania? Who knows? Who knows? Fortunately, I had someone to turn to. Or without mentors, I might well still be mulling over those 9 files of newspaper clippings about Eleanor H. Little, who was a member of the Connecticut Unemployment Commission in the late 1930s. But there was someone there to kick my butt and to say, Nancy, move on, move on. Sometimes we don't have the luxury of reviewing material before we say, hey, this is great stuff, or no, thank you. While running the public services operations of an archives for years, I was the front person for some interesting and unusual instant appraisal decisions. So we're constantly doing appraisal, whether we are focused on technical services or focused on public service. Last year, I talked about the wonderful strategy for handling the possible donation of crew socks from the head of the Charles in 1963. As a public service person at the front desk, someone came in and said, hey, I've got these great, something great that the archives would love. They turned out to be crew socks. Dirty, worn, smelly crew socks.
Did they pass the smell test?
I said, no, thank you. Or at Smith now, I sort of get the female version, which is gym suits. Wouldn't you like my gym suit from 1943? Thank you. No. But the historical clothing collection at Smith will take it on. Thank goodness for them.
The crew socks.
So one of the things to do is, and actually it's really quite it's a godsend, is to have somewhere that you can point other people to when you appraise. So what I do at Smith for more than a decade has been to document the life of the college. And fortunately, I work for a place that has a great institutional history and is composed of many communities on campus that have a good sense of their place in the history of higher education. We go into offices, we appraise, we work very strongly with the staff who are creating the records. We show them what we already have in the archives, accessioned from their office. We tell them, this is what these records are used for, this is how they're used, and then we sort of do a pre-approval. I'm in a house hunt, so I'm using, you know, the pre-approval, pre-appraisal, you know, terms. So it's kind of like, okay, Office of the President, these are the files that we have had from you over the years, this is how they're being used, you can have them back if you want, you can come and use them, please don't take them away, really, and this is what we want from you in the future. Rarely, when the boxes come, do we have to weed them? We ask for a records transmittal form beforehand just to take a look at the file titles. Everything is good. We're moving this into the departments where we're getting much more material and really good stuff. Some colleagues would call this records retention scheduling. We call it service. And it's really, really great because it allows us time to go after those renegade offices that have never sent us anything, that we know have really, really good stuff, and then to talk with our IT people about all sorts of things related to the digital and the electronic. So what might I suggest for future archivist appraisers? Get as much hands-on experience as you can, either individually or in groups. Spend time studying systems that that organizations use for obtaining records. Are they sustainable? I promised not to use that word. Do these systems optimize the skill of your colleagues? Is there clear communication and cross-training between offices that provide records and appraisals? Sharpen those fact-gathering skills. Broaden our knowledge of everything. Your institution does not work in a vacuum, even though you might think it does. Listen and observe to what is happening around your community. Know the strengths of your current collection. Look for opportunities to fill the gaps. And this is a piece that I sort of want to push. Don't waste time trying to perfect the archives. There's no perfect archives out there. And unless you can hire and supervise innumerable staff, you will never be able to gather together all of the material of enduring value of your institution. Know that you will have to make judgments about records, for good or ill. However, if you can make an informed decision about what it is you are trying to appraise, then you can go to sleep at night with a good and not a guilty conscience. So the road of appraisal is often potholed and backed up with construction traffic, but there are always exits and on-ramps to use on your journey. I checked, and there are currently no AAA triptychs available for the road of appraisal. So it's all about meandering, but with knowledge and purpose. Don't be afraid to explore those scenic routes of any experience. And yes, take along a sandwich and soda so that you can sustain yourself in the journey. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I want to welcome all the late arrivals. I only assume you're here because you heard Frank Bull's excellent speech last night on talked about appraisal, the centrality of appraisal, and I'll now open the floor to questions. And we'll have to repeat the questions for the mic. Questions? Comments? Okay. Yes?
Oh, the three presentations, there was sort of an underlying theme that I detected, which is that appraisal arises primarily from an examination and study of the materials. And yet, when I was in school, and at times since then, I've either confronted or found other people confronted by, other archivists confronted by a situation where somebody comes and says, okay, we've only got this much storage space, so cut this down to half its volume. In other words, you start not from the material, but from the fact that you've got to cut this down to half its volume. Could you comment on that kind of consideration? Some of the same themes apply, but it's obviously, it seems like it sets the priorities very differently.
Well, I just wrote down as a note for myself that one of the things that we have to say from the outset, particularly as you, in the case of fast appraisals, in the case of appraisals of that kind, in the case of appraisals that face many kinds of constraints about how much you can have or how quickly you can do it, that the huge challenge of appraisal, I mean, we wouldn't be here, you know, if it weren't for the fact that we have to make decisions that are virtuous decisions on the basis of radically inadequate knowledge. We don't have time to look at everything. Now, we had a big discussion yesterday about how you can use digital tools to look at digital stuff a lot better than you can paper, but still, you're always operating in this kind of an environment. And now, where do you stand? And that's where you need to actually be familiar with things that will say to you, okay, there might be statistical tools you could use to sample, or there might be this, or there might be that, to sort of mitigate the situation you may find yourself in.
I agree.
I don't really have anything very enlightening to say, but what I would say is that weeding and post-custodial appraisal did come up with people I interviewed, and it seems to me that that's something that should be considered. I mean, we need to think about what that means, and particularly for I'm interested in archival education, and so it seems to me that that's something we should be teaching about. Thinking about that and not just ideals. I don't know. It has to be ideals within parameters.
Also, not to be flippant with your comment or with my comment. You know, appraisal doesn't end once the material comes through the door. I mean, certainly there's the processing appraisal, but then there's reappraisal. And so being confronted with something that you might take in, you know, half of what you might take in, a year later you might take a look at it and say, oh, well, geez, you know, even the stuff I took in wasn't really worth it in the long run. So we continually have to view appraisal as it's in every part of our lives. So, and sometimes it is a crapshoot. There's no question about it. The issue is then, really, is it okay?
hasn't died.
Did it not die?
You didn't come to the appraisal section yesterday. So tough, you know. I mean,
I find the disc.
He was asking that why we hadn't mentioned documentation strategy, and I think we were kind of weren't charged to talk about specific methods or anything, and we're saying that the appraisal section, the appraisal, what is it called, appraisal and accession section, yesterday there was a lengthy discussion of documentation strategy and how it hasn't died a death and how people have actually been doing sort of secretly documentation strategy for a long time.
That just didn't come up with the respondents I spoke to. I think you said you came in a little late, right? This was an exploratory study where I only talked to a few people. It's not statistically valid in any way whatsoever. It was more, what kinds of themes are emerging? And so it just didn't come up for the people I talked to.
One of the interesting things that came out of that discussion yesterday about documentation strategy, even though it's kind of passé now, is that it did wonderful things for the profession. I mean, it got archivists to really address the questions of why they were collecting things and really thinking about what they were doing and being reflexive practitioners, as you were commenting.
Yeah.
So it's still very much relevant, I think.
Well, and another thing that we talked about was the fact that with the emergence of the notion of cultural privacy and, in fact, specific small archives being controlled by the people who created the materials increasingly for at least some period of time, that's going to happen and will probably continue to happen going forward, or where we're seeing archives that are developing outreach programs in order to collect from their community more broadly. This is all about documentation strategy and many of the practices. It's never really gone away. It has entered the practice as outreach or as something else.
Yes.
The comment about reappraisal reminds me of a conversation I had with a French colleague many years ago. It was extremely pragmatic. And I was asking him why he held his institution to permanent value. Why wasn't it sufficient if you had identified records as having enduring value that you could bring them in? The answer was, for one simple reason, we have limited resources. So the only thing we're going to deal with is records that we cannot possibly imagine any condition under which we get rid of. And so it's kind of a negative approach to appraisal. But I'm wondering, what's your reaction to that?
What is my reaction?
I'm going to try to paraphrase that.
Go ahead. The issue of reappraising and appraisal and how we come to collect enduring material and our French counterparts permanent material. What is permanent is the question. And that's a philosophical question. And I'm not a philosopher. So I think that given all of the things that archivists do, that we really attempt to do the best we can within our institutions. Sometimes doing the best we can means that we take on material that we would not normally take on because it doesn't fit within our collecting policy. It doesn't fit within what we ourselves are interested in. I think there's always that factor too. There are times when we actually have to reevaluate. We have to find the time to reevaluate. Have we done a good job? Have we collected what we really should be? Is there space? Is there a way for us to make physical space for things that are coming in the future? I mean, I think we all share the situation where we have 600 linear feet of space and we have 1,200 potential feet of material. So what is going to give? How are we going to reformat it to make it more space efficient. If the French can do it, great.
Well, they've had a lot more practice than we have.
They have.
My students will let you know that I'm not even a closet keeper. I'm a keeper. And I'm also very interested in the notion of corpora and what it takes and what, your weeding will be my context. This whole kind of notion of sort of keeping materials that are, in fact, context and not maybe the main show. But, I mean, one of the things that strikes me as very important is, and that I don't know whether it'll change the environment or not, because there still won't be very much space for paper, when we are able to expose in greater detail the contents of our holdings to the public, then when all the issues of use are going to really change things. If we're really going to say, okay, use is important, then all of a sudden we've got floods of people wanting to see stuff that we didn't think was maybe worth collecting, and all of a sudden we see that the long tail is, wrapped around our necks. And people are saying, okay, well, we want to use this. And we didn't know that, or the people who collected it didn't know that, and we never do. But that's really going to change the climate, I think. The better job we do of exposing finding aids and the more detail we can give people, first of all, there'll be very much more focused visits, but also the kind of access that people are able to get will lead them to expose interest in materials that we really didn't necessarily know had that much interest. Once you can actually have the million people on Earth who want to look at this, see it, then all of a sudden you realize it's not a minority interest unless you want to ignore, a million people. So that's going to really change things. And then with the digital, the issue of space, I keep telling my students storage is free. And over the last year, I've attended 3 conferences, at each of which I got a gigabyte thumb drive for, well, free, but, pretty much free, yeah. And I thought to myself, well, we're getting there. But, I mean, that kind of whole notion of and I've been very inspired by the article that's now kind of old by Peter Botticelli, looking at network organizations and what the meaning is in the holdings of the materials developed by and created by people in a network, and how do you actually appraise that if you don't appraise the whole thing somehow. You have to at least appraise the whole thing, and you have the opportunity of doing that because you can look at it. You can search it. So,
well, along these lines, the question of permanent versus enduring value is sort of related. Well, it's deeply related to the question of for who. One of the advantages to the enduring value approach is that you can defer ultimate decision-making into the future. And the for who might change in the future, and as we've seen in our own lives. And I mean, that's such a big underlying question for all archival practice that I don't think we have an answer right now, but that's a good question.
Yes.
A couple of you have mentioned digital information. Has the availability of new kinds of information about students, student life, life on campus in the digital world, have you thought about, what are you thinking about appraising that kind of information for the archives?
Memorize FERPA first.
I'm sorry?
Memorize FERPA first, because there's law that won't let you, or that will have you closing it.
One of the reasons I wanted to study appraisal right now with university archivists is because I feel they have some issues coming up with electronic records, and I think that there's going to be a lot more conscious activity with appraisal at the moment in new ways. So, yes, I think it's an issue. I don't have an answer, though.
Well, one thing I learned, I had a student who is now coming as a PhD student, but she did a master's thesis on the registrar's office and its electronic records, and I learned, much to my surprise, maybe all of you know this, you probably know this, that registrars have their own sort of archival thing going on. They are very well informed in the archival literature. They, as a group, have gone together and have standards, et cetera, because on most campuses, they're the ones who are charged with permanently preserving those records.
That wasn't really what I was trying to get at. I'm sorry.
Okay.
What I was trying to get at is the stuff available on the web about student organizations, That sort of thing. That was what I was really trying to get at. I'm sorry.
The question relates to
material on the web related to student organizations.
Student organizations, athletics, you know, there are lots of things that is up there now that tells a lot about the culture of the campus.
Right. We've been looking into outsourcing that because at a small liberal arts college, there are multiple constituents who are at the door of ITS, the technology folks. And sadly, they also show no interest in doing this from the preservation aspect that archivists know and understand and love. We, after many years, still have not really moved forward to having a good working relationship with our ITS colleagues. So we are looking into outsourcing issues, archive it, a number of other things. It does concern me because certainly, you know, student newspapers up to 2008, great paper format, nicely bound. We can microfilm them, we can digitize them. But now, you know, everything is moving towards the digital content. Other college publications as well are, you know, striking terror in my heart over this. So it's a great question. But I also think that there needs to be a lot more educational opportunities within SAA, within other organizations, where we can really tap into more of professional development in this area.
We've been, we created an institutional repository for the School of Information in 2005, and one of the things that student teams will work on is our own stuff, which will include, because obviously we have a website. Our website is very sort of reticulated and has all kinds of different things on it. Some things are not really permanent. Some things people don't wish to have preserved, et cetera. So there are all kinds of things like that. So all the questions arise. And it's very, since it's our own material, we have one ulterior motive, which is that as a school of information, of course, it's useful to us to see what stupid websites we made in the past and how, you know, how we have progressed in the method of creating websites and the whole sort of issue of information architecture, et cetera. So we have some really good reasons to appraise as permanent or as enduring that are over and beyond the content. So that's a good excuse. But it's been very interesting to look at how you would look at these different parts and pieces, just of a website.
At UCLA, we recently, I don't get credit for this at all, there's recently been started a program called the Bruin Archiving Project, in which we've matched the, meaning the University Archives has matched the information school archive students with student organizations, because currently the archive didn't have enough, I mean, there's just like one person now. Not enough staff to work with student organizations, and the advantage to the archive students is it's their show. They get to process, they get to they get to appraise, they get to work with the student organizations, and we've actually been getting some things in for permanent collections that never would have come in otherwise. The Charlotte Brown is the university archivist at UCLA, and so if you'd like to hear more about that, you might want to talk to her.
Brings in the question of bringing the creators and the users into the process of appraisal, too. Yeah. Yes?
The question was, there was a comment made at a previous conference in which someone said appraisals are relevant in the digital era. That's a big, okay. I have to say, I find that sort of disturbing because basic, and again, I come from a library/archives background, and so I know a bit about information retrieval and deluge of information, and I just can't perceive how you would have masses of information that are all sort of drivel and be able to make use of that. One of the points of appraisal is to select the useful stuff. I just don't see how that changes once the formats change.
I think with the digital world, it's ever more increasingly important to appraise. What will the challenges be in order to actually get the opportunity to appraise? Pat will talk about that because that's one of the things she likes to talk about. But you know, exactly. I mean, for exactly the reason that how many of us, you know, now routinely take 500 images of vacation things, and it's like, oh, I don't have to go through this anymore. You know, I don't have to delete the fuzzy ones. I don't have to delete the ones where, you know, I've cut my partner's head off. It's just going to go on the thumb drive or, you know, in my hard drive. It's really scary as an archivist to think what is out there to be appraised, and we won't even talk about email.
Pat will.
No, but I will. No. Well, I teach digital archives, and I like to keep it all. But well, I mean, the issue really is also, in some ways, the whole keep it all is while we figure out what to do, because that is possible, at least in some, not at NARA, but they have too much, but you know, but a lot of other people do not have too much. And we are working on this. Again, you know, I have had a dissertation a couple of years ago, which is actually looking at a digital tool for appraisal, to ways of evaluating great big chunks of stuff using data mining techniques, et cetera, et cetera. And these are things that we really do need to become conversant with. I mean, records managers are already facing digital discovery. Those tools are interesting as well. And we've got colleagues who know something about it. So I think the whole issue of digital materials take us out of that place which I mentioned where, you know, we have radically inadequate knowledge of the contents of the stuff that's on paper. Potentially, we don't have to have radically inadequate knowledge of the digital materials that we face. And we can realize instantly that it's all dribble or not, you know. I mean, but the insecurity and the reluctance has always been based on this knowledge that our knowledge is radically inadequate for big clumps of material that we have no way of going through. And no, we can't necessarily go through it in detail digitally, but we do have the capability, and increasingly we will, getting archivists involved in building these tools so that we can actually troll through the materials and actually figure out what's there. Is it relevant? Does it comply with what we expect to be there in case it's an official record, et cetera, et cetera?
Last question.
Actually, I want to make a comment on that, because speaking from tons of experience,
yes.
Digital storage is the bottom of the archival iceberg. Mm-hmm. And you can't do digital appraisal without thinking about the other consequences on archives. NARA has 25 archivists who are working on the George W. Bush collection. Mm. One of the very bright young archivists who's working on this told us last year as we were developing the system, if you guys fail, we're dead. If you don't have a system that we can use to handle this volume of material, we are absolutely dead. On the other hand, if you succeed, we are absolutely dead. Because we have 300 million electronic records in the Bush White House. 25 records cannot handle 300 million records.
Of course not.
Very sensitive. So even in small institutions, you need to look at, what are you going to do with these records when they come through the door? Can you handle them? Can you provide service to them? Do your users really want a Google search where they get 150,000 hits when there may only be a few hundred documents that they're actually interested in?
Well, I mean, actually, most users really would like to have a Google search if they have the opportunity. They'll see. I mean, you know, that's the issue. But the thing is that I think we are getting lots of places where we haven't been before, and business is driving it. All the grants that we see coming into iSchools, the largest amounts of money are going for information retrieval because the federal government wants it for Homeland Security, okay? So there's a lot of money going into it that wasn't going into it before. I mean, it's huge. Hopefully we'll be able to benefit from that. And I think, you know, if we take the sort of bull by the horns, as it were, and get involved in some of those projects with an archival perspective, then maybe we'll be able to profit by it.
Okay, one more question.
Well, it's actually just a carrying on leverage them into our own processes.
I mean, another thing that's a little bit closer to our field of interest is for years and years and years, computational linguistics kind of languished because they had the Brown corpus, but that was about it because everybody in the olden days had to type everything in to have a corpus to work with. Now computational linguistics is exploding because they've got Google searches, they've got the Enron email, they've got all these things to work with, and computational linguistics is one of the resource areas that will serve this task. And amazing things are coming out of there. So I really think it's important that we keep an eye on these things. As I say, I don't know if you talked with Maria Esteva when she went to UBC last year, 2008, I think. Okay. But this is the area that she's working in. She's now at our supercomputer center working further on her visualization work. This kind of thing. That's another thing. A tool doesn't necessarily mean you have to read every word. Visualization techniques will enable you to see kind of the shape of the collection.
Okay. I want to thank everyone for coming out this morning.
Thank you.
Thank our speakers, too. Thank you.